Isabel Hardman. Thank you very much indeed. That's it from all of us here this Easter Sunday. Next, What the Papers Say.
Welcome to What the Papers Say with me, Kevin Maguire. The stunning front page of The Independent graphically captured the horror of
darkness in the heart of Europe.
A scared passengers escaped on the tracks from a destroyed metro train. Suicide bombers of the so-called Islamic State murdering 31 people on the Brussels underground and at the city's airport. Most newspaper front pages carried the picture of three airport terrorists pushing luggage trolleys, carrying deadly suitcase explosives. In The Sun, they were
primed suspects.
In The Daily Mirror,
the death squad.
This was horrific bloodshed, just over a couple of hours by train from London, and every national newspaper led on it except the Daily Star, which inexplicably preferred
Easter eggs are banned.
I won't trouble you with the details of that garbage when a human tragedy with huge political and security implications was unfolding. The Daily Mail's correspondent in Brussels, John Stevens, recounted the start of the carnage.
Seconds after a man cried out, Allah Akbar, God is great, the airport apocalypse began. As passengers queued to check in for flights at around 8 a.m. local time, the first blast rang out. Moments later, as people fled towards the entrance of Brussels Zaventem Airport, a second, much bigger blast in front of them brought down much of the ceiling and sent razor-sharp shrapnel, body parts and clouds of thick dust and smoke billowing through the building.
For The Guardian, a bleeding air stewardess in the terminal, sitting stunned in torn yellow jacket and shredded trousers, was
the photograph that has come to define the horrors of the terror attacks in Brussels.
After it went around the world, accelerated by social media. By the end of the week, we learned David Dixon, a Brit missing in Brussels since the tube blast, was confirmed dead. Amid the ensuing police raids, shootings, soul-searching, blame games, catastrophic errors uncovered, and the hunt for the
man in the hat
pictured at the airport, a London Evening Standard splash in the middle of the week, he was
captured,
proving premature, though the Daily Star Sunday splash
got him,
partly atoned for its earlier lack of coverage. The Observer explained,
Belgian prosecutors charged a man identified as Faisal Chefu with playing a core role in the suicide bomb attacks.
The paper described him as
a self-styled journalist in his 30s whose older brother was shot and killed by Belgian police more than a decade ago. Thought to be the man in the hat captured on CCTV at Brussels Airport, alongside bombers Ibrahim El Bakrawi and Nahim Lakrawi, Chefu was one of several men detained in police raids on Thursday.
Before his arrest, the Daily Mail asked, reasonably enough,
how many more jihadi bombers are out there?
The Sun answered the following day,
five bombers on loose.
In Brussels, the Daily Express, never knowingly understated, asserted
300 jihadists on our
that's Britain's
streets.
The coverage was as frenetic as a security operation, with links discovered to the Paris slaughters and Turkey, from where one of the bombers was deported as a jihadi. The Belgian authorities found themselves on trial. French paper Le Monde had a shocking story on Saturday, declaring,
according to the interview transcripts which Le Monde was able to access, the only captured ringleader of the Paris attacks had been put under interrogation for just 2 hours since his arrest on the 18th of March.
The Sunday Times described
a bruising outbreak of international fury at Belgian security lapses that had allowed ISIS to strike once again at the heart of a major European city.
The paper reflected
the brutal riposte to what had briefly seemed like a breakthrough in counter-terrorist operations.
We've got him,
tweeted one jubilant Belgian official after Abdeslam's arrest, sparked intensive sweeps for suspected ISIS militants in several European countries.
The Sunday Times added,
Belgian police now believe that the attacks on the airport and the metro were intended to coincide with a third attack to be led by Abdeslam on the tourist-packed Grand Place in Brussels and a separate assault on a popular Easter festival near Paris.
Displays of solidarity with Belgians included, as The Guardian recorded, the sharing of one of that country's most celebrated figures.
Pictures of Tintin, the boy reporter hero of the comic strip by the cartoonist Hergé, spread rapidly around the web as people sought an embodiment of the country. Most of them showed Tintin weeping or lying unconscious with his dog, Snowy, howling over him.
Yet, sadly, Tintin will probably no more protect Belgians than Je suis Charlie Twitter hashtags prevented a second Islamist assault on Paris. Britain isn't immune from Islamist terror, as the 7/7 bombings, murder of soldier Lee Rigby, and this week's convictions of two would-be drive-by jihadis prove. Brussels inevitably raised questions about security in Britain and the European Union ahead of June's landmark referendum. The Daily Telegraph led on Sir Richard Dearlove, a former MI6 chief, telling Prospect magazine,
"Whether one is an enthusiastic European or not, the truth about Brexit from a national security perspective is that the cost to Britain would be low."
He was to be contradicted in the Sunday Telegraph by US General David Petraeus, former commander of forces in Afghanistan and Iraq, and a former director of the CIA.
"I encourage my British friends to think twice before withdrawing from one of the most important institutions that undergirds Western strength, the European Union."
Don't worry, there's only 3 months left to the referendum. Over in the Mail, Yasmin Alabaya Brown popped up to lay the blame for jihadis very close to home. In fact, in homes.
"Brutality begins at home. In looking for the reasons behind Tuesday's Belgian atrocities, we have to face the fact that the ultimate cause lies in the upbringing of the killers.
Yet we must recognise theology, however warped, is a motivator for jihadis, and at the same time as journalists avoid demonising every Muslim. The Sun will have been embarrassed to carry a column-length adjudication by the Independent Press Standards Organisation that is much mocked November assertion,
1 in 5 Brit Muslims' sympathy for jihadis,
was
significantly misleading,
and breached the accuracy clause 1 of the editor's code of practice. The Brussels bombings reverberated in Cuba, where US President Barack Obama, on an historic visit to end 6 decades of Uncle Sam, some might say, bullying the island's communist regime, was criticised by opponents back home. The Mail reported online,
"Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani ripped into President Barack Obama for attending a baseball game in Cuba yesterday afternoon instead of jumping on his plane and coming home after the Brussels attack.
Because
you don't send a picture of yourself laughing while people have just been blown up at a level that is equivalent to September 11 to one of our allies."
Seismic events outside Britain, especially those Brussels bombings, diverted media coverage from fratricide within a Conservative Party which started the week generating a blizzard of unfavourable headlines.
"Civil war engulfs Tories.
Tories plunge into open warfare.
Damned,"
shouted the Mail, Guardian and Mirror, as the fallout of George Osborne's botched budget and Ian Duncan Smith's explosive resignation set blue against blue. IDS was the quiet man turning up the volume to a shattering pitch. It was, for the Mail's Quentin Letts, a coming of age for a much-mocked politician.
For years, the strategy modernisers scoffed at Ian Duncan Smith. Downing Street cockpit boys, swaggering intimates of power, belittled this bald, croaky-voiced ex-guards officer and his street-level Tory paternalism.
As did sketchwriters such as, Mr. Letts. Anyway, he continued,
"George Osborne thought IDS a loser, too thick to run the welfare system. Well, he wasn't a loser yesterday. In the most scintillating political outburst since Michael Heseltine strutted out of the Thatcher government in 1986, IDS gave an interview to the Andrew Marr programme. He erupted. Kaboom! Scoop for Marr, calamity for George Osborne."
Osborne was ridiculed for refusing to confront Labour's John McDonnell in the House of Commons.
"Where is Wally?"
inquired the Mirror.
"Where's Ozzy?"
demanded the Sun. AWOL George endured the indignity of IDS's replacement, Stephen Crabb, announcing the cancellation of £4 billion worth of budget disability cuts. The pro-Britain out of Europe Daily Express purred,
"Whether he intended to or not, Mr. Duncan Smith has pushed Britain another step closer to leaving the EU."
The Express's joy was too much for Britain and Europe's Polly Toynbee, who claimed IDS was so desperate to get the country out of the EU, he was even prepared, shock, horror, to come clean on his own cuts.
"This man's only intent,"
she fumed in the Guardian,
"is to get Britain out of the EU."
Over at the Daily Telegraph, mischievous scribbler Michael Deacon suggested cheekily,
"Surely every Labour member can now see what a mistake they made last September. They should never have chosen Jeremy Corbyn as their leader. Instead, they should have chosen Ian Duncan Smith."
They're not laughing now after Corbyn failed to throw at Cameron IDS's damaging accusations the Tories were dividing Britain and hurting the poor to slip money to the richer. As John Crace scoffed in The Guardian,
It's an easy mistake to make. You've been away on a silent yoga retreat. You spent the entire weekend watching Sky Sports. You overslept and all the newspapers had been sold by the time you got to Coscutter. These things happen. It's just a bit unfortunate.
Unfortunate? Nice use of understatement.
It's just a bit unfortunate when you happen to be the leader of the Labour Party and you've managed to miss the biggest crisis in the Conservative Party since the last election.
That Corbyn era was followed by the slipping to Times deputy political editor Sam Coates of a loyalty list compiled within the party. As Coates explained to readers...
Jeremy Corbyn's allies have ranked every Labour MP by their loyalty to the leadership in an extraordinary spreadsheet, which labels Rosie Winterton, the chief whip, and Sadiq Khan, the party's candidate for Mayor of London, as hostile. A document leaked to the Times reveals Labour MPs have been divided into five groups. It shows Mr Corbyn has more opponents than supporters. And the list prompted one Labour MP to draw comparisons with Richard Nixon, former US president, who drew up lists of
enemies.
Thought to have been left in a Commons bar, Corbyn's insistence he knew nothing about it didn't save him from the father of all ribbons by Cameron at Prime Minister's Questions. Yet Corbyn ended the week basking in a standing ovation at a teachers' union conference, and Cameron sipping a beer with Sam Cam in Lanzarote. And I'd wager both buried their differences to enjoy a scathing assault on Boris Johnson by Matthew Paris in the Times. You can gauge his take on a potential Johnson premiership from this extract.
Incompetence is not funny. Policy vacuum is not funny. Administrative sloth is not funny. Breaking promises is not funny. A careless disregard for the truth is not funny. Advising old mates planning to beat somebody up is not funny. Abortions and gagging orders are not funny. Creeping ambition in a Chester's cap is not funny. Vacuity posing as merriment, cynicism posing as savviness, a wink and smile covering for betrayal. These things are not funny.
Nick Cohen was equally vicious in The Observer, and Petronella Wyatt discussing in the Mail on Sunday intimate details of her special friendship with a blonde bombshell when both toiled at the Spectator.
A substantial affection can arise when two people are thrown together. We became close friends in our labours and in our ease. We had what the French call an amitié amoureuse.
She cooed. I wonder what Mrs. Johnson called it reading the papers over breakfast. A newspaper tragedy was the end on Saturday of the printed Independent after 30 years of gracing newsstands.
Stop press!
Announced the cover of the last copy. Falling sales and financial losses forcing it online. Though the mini-me I it spawned will live on in newsagents. The Independent was revolutionary in its day and forced other newspapers to improve. It was an important liberal voice in what is largely a Tory press. Editor Amal Rajan put on a brave face as he leapt into cyberspace.
The Independent has changed journalism itself for the better. And with our latest move, I think we can do it again.
The Observer's veteran media commentator Peter Preston wished it well.
Tomorrow morning, the digital spirit of the old indie must do battle in the scabrous, often savage land of the net, battling for survival against the likes of Vice, BuzzFeed, Vox and Gawker. Good luck to the online indie, and good luck to the Independent, wherever and whenever its name fits the news.
This is also the final episode of What the Papers Say on Radio 4. I wish all good things didn't come to an end. Good night.
That was What the Papers Say, a Granada TV format presented by Kevin Maguire of The Mirror. The editor was Catherine Donegan. The editor of The Westminster Hour was John Beasley. After the news, the Moth Radio Hour, celebrating all things British.